And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
Welcome, everybody. Hands on Apologetics. You have entered into your Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo, and I am your sensei and host, Gary Machuda. Great to be with you today. Today is the August 27th broadcast. And by the way, folks, this is something interesting that Hands on Apologetics, the Midwest Command Center here, got powered up, and the dojo began service in early October of last year. So we're actually coming up on our first year anniversary, not too much more to go, you know, just a month away or so. And so it's kind of cool. You know, we're approaching that thing. And I don't know, I'm going to have to think of throughout September, figure out some way we could celebrate, have a special show, you know, to commemorate 1 year on the air. I don't know. So yeah, send me some suggestions. I appreciate it. But, you know, it's really the success of the show and the fact that I am still here is really due to you, the listener. You know, thank you so much for all your prayers, for your financial contributions to Virgin Most Powerful. And also, most of all, sharing. I mean, back when I started, there wasn't very many people. I'm not sure how many subscribers we had. I think it was less than 1,000 on YouTube. And we were just kind of coming into our own, but it's been growing and growing. And that's because of you, spreading the word, telling people about Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing, liking, doing all that social stuff, you know, that has helped us grow. And please, you know, continue to do so, because there's a lot of souls out there that could be helped by, you know, learning how to share, defend the faith, and also all the great stuff here on Virgin Most Powerful. So keep praying, keep contributing, keep sharing. Love it. And like I said, we'll have to come up with some sort of anniversary idea. And while I'm speaking about social media, I want to do my shout out early today. We're going to give our shout outs to all those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everyone. Great to see familiar names there in the forum of YouTube. And also, I want to thank all of you listening live on radio across America and into Europe and other places of the world. Yes, we are international as well. So welcome, and thank you for the emojis. Appreciate it. And let's see, you know, this week is a cool week. I didn't have a chance to actually introduce. Usually I kind of give a tease for all the guests that are going to be on for this week. And I didn't do it yesterday, so I might as well. Of course, yesterday we talked to Bruce Sullivan. And by the way, this week kind of encompasses everything we've done over the year. It's, you know, a wide variety. Bruce Sullivan, he's a regular here on Virgin Most Powerful's Hands-On Apologetics. Convert from Church of Christ. We talked about development of doctrine yesterday. Today's guest is, well, you know what? I'll tell you at the end. How about that for a cliffhanger? Tomorrow we're going to have a newcomer, Jeff Kassab. He's becoming a mover and shaker here in Southeast Michigan. And he's going to share his journey of faith. In fact, he's going to be in the dojo itself. He's going to be sitting right next to me tomorrow. And Thursday we have the blue-collar apologist himself, John Martinoni. And Friday, none other than Master Apologist Jimmy Akin of Catholic Answers is going to come into the dojo. Well, actually, he's going to join us otherwise. He's going to talk about his new book. So, I mean, that's kind of a snapshot of what we've been doing here on the show. We got seasoned veterans. We have people who are specialized fields of study. And we also introduce newcomers, people that you should know because you're going to hear, most likely hear a lot of them in the future. So that's the kind of thing we do. And I can't forget, what about today's show, you're wondering? Well, we're going to talk about actual hands-on apologetics in the sense that does one size fit all when it comes to sharing and defending the faith? In other words, can you assume that the person you're talking to fits the standard portrait or keyhole, or should you treat everybody the same? And if not, why? Well, to help us work through that, we have our guest Matt Swaim coming on the show. And many of you are already familiar with Matt's work. He was the host of Sunrise Morning Show. He replaced Brian Patrick when he moved to EWTN on that show. Did a great job, and now he's working with Coming Home Network, where he has lots of experience with explaining, defending the faith, and welcoming people into the church. So great stuff coming up on the other side of the break. And as always, we do our Finding the Fallacy. And by the way, the Finding the Fallacy today is the misleading vividness. And we also meet an early church father, learn a little about him. And today's early church father is not somebody that you probably have ever heard before, but nevertheless, he is an important figure, and he is among the ranks of the early church fathers. Who is it? Liporius. Liporius, a 5th century early church father. So lots of great stuff in store for us today. By the way, if you have any questions, comments, maybe you want to share your situation, kind of bounce things off the wall with our guest on the other side of the break, you can always give us a call toll-free, 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Or you can always send your questions to questions@handsonapologetics.com. So great stuff in store. Why don't we jump into our Finding the Fallacy, shall we? Today's fallacy is the misleading vividness fallacy. And basically what it is this. It's a type of logical fallacy which where someone will use a small number of dramatic events to claim that something is more prevalent than it actually is based on statistics. So they're using misleading vividness to give a disproportional view of something. Okay, this is also known, otherwise known as the anecdotal fallacy. And this is an important one because really you can make something seem like it is so prevalent that you can't go out your door without running into it by like highlighting a few small numbers of extremely dramatic events. And that can lead to a misrepresentation of the data. I think a good example of this, I think, is airplane travel. Why? Because we only hear about when something goes wrong in airplane flight, God forbid, when an airplane crashes. And so by listening to the news, you only hear about airplanes crashing. You never hear about the thousands and thousands of airplane flights that make it safely to their destination. So that could lead to the misleading vividness fallacy, where one might think that air travel is extremely dangerous and that, planes are always falling from the sky, when in fact the opposite is true. So I think that's probably a good example of that, but this could be used in other cases as well. So usually if someone brings up some anecdotes, certain events, certain things that they want to expound on, the thing you need to do is, especially if it's very emotional, you need to step back and look at the statistic and say, okay, these are bad, but how does this compare to everything else? Kind of put things in perspective. And I think that ultimately is how you defeat this logical fallacy, which is misleading vividness. Aha. Very good. All right. Well, why don't we jump to the Meet the Early Church Father for today? Like I said, the cool thing about this program is we go through these early church fathers. Like the other day, we talked about St. Cyprian of Carthage. Big, big, important early church father. Lots of writings. But there's also these obscure ones that you never hear about that didn't really leave a lot, but nevertheless are important to know. And today's Meet the Early Church Father happens to fall into that category. It is Liporius, who flourished sometime around AD 426. Now, I don't have a lot of biographical material on him. Basically, he was a monk in Gaul. And by the way, Gaul is the what is now modern-day France. So whenever you hear about the early church fathers and you talk about the bishops of Gaul, just in your mind, substitute Gaul for France. Okay. In fact, he was a part of the Diocese of Treves. Because of his heretical doctrines, he was obliged to leave his monastery and become a homeless wanderer. So he's kind of kicked out of the monastery because of heretical beliefs. And he just hits the road, travels around Europe. And throughout his journeys, he ends up, of all places, in North Africa, where he comes in contact with one of the greatest doctors of the church. You guessed it, St. Augustine, the great bishop and doctor of Hippo in North Africa. So, you know, what's the odds of that? I don't know if he sought out Augustine or his travels just he ended up there. But, you know, remember back in the 4th century, though, North Africa was, that was more or less like a major center of Christianity. It wasn't like after the invasion of Islam. So, you know, it wouldn't be unusual for Christians to travel to North Africa. But nevertheless, he runs into the greatest doctor in the church, St. Augustine. And what does St. Augustine do? Well, he's able to straighten out all this crooked thinking of this monk named Liporius. So at the Council of Carthage, we're not really sure when the date was. Most likely it was around 426 AD. Liporius submitted a profession of his now reformed faith. And this was forwarded to the father. Not only it was forwarded, this confession of faith, by the fathers of this council in Carthage, two of all people, the bishops of Gaul. Okay. And so in a sense, along with the cover letter, which is known in its Latin, I'll translate it for you, the epistle of the bishops of Africa to the bishops of Gaul. And by the way, it's also found in Augustine's letters. Recommending now the non-Orthodox and properly chastened Liporius back into the fold. And he also has the document of his confession of faith where he professes Orthodox understanding of Christ. So that is our early church father for today, Liporius. Coming up on the other side of the break, Matt Swaim. And we're going to talk about explaining the faith to one person. Does one size fit all?
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
In Luke 7, Jesus said, "I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven her, because she has been shown great love." According to St. John of the Cross, Christians should always remember that the value of their good works is not based on number and excellence. Their value is based on the love for God that prompts them to do the works. May we always be motivated by true love for God, and not worry so much about what we do, but why we do it.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. And the name tells you what we are doing here. In fact, today's program, I think, really fits with our name because, you know, it's important to know how to share your faith. You know, many times we can make mistakes. We can presuppose things that actually kind of hinder the effort to share the good news about Christ and his fullness and his church. And, you know, one of those factors is to kind of figure that there is just one apology, one size fits all that equally applies to everybody. That is a mistake that needs to be avoided. And to kind of explore that, we have none other than Master Apologist Matt Swaim. Matt Swaim, by the way, grew up in a strong Christian home, attended United Methodist, Nazarene, and Free Methodist congregations along the way. While studying media communications at Asbury College, he discovered G.K. Chesterton, and because at first curious about the Catholic faith, then he eventually became convicted, came into the church. He spent over a decade in Catholic radio, and he now coordinator I promote new videos and other media content for chnetwork.org. Write that down, folks. Important website. Matt Swaim, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Gary. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, well, it's always a joy because, man, yeah, you not only do you have a really interesting journey of the faith, but you know, your years in radio, it's fun to banter with you because you're a radio guy. I'm not. I'm just a, you know, an elderly apologist trying to have to make a fool of himself for an hour.
I would not be in radio if I didn't have all these smart friends. I mean, I don't talk about anything of my own. I just bring on other smart people and just get them in and out of breaks. So, I mean, hey, it's tailor-made. I don't have to talk about anything important. I just line other people up, get them to do the hard stuff.
Yeah, well, yeah, easier said than done. I'm able to mess that up, even though that's a great formula. But anyway, yeah, let's talk about apologetics. This is an interesting topic, you know, because it's so easy to pigeonhole, you know, people and things and kind of have your one-shot argument or something. But, you know, apologetics, you really need to focus down into the individual level, don't you?
You really do. Of course, you know, you mentioned our work with the Coming Home Network. I already kind of knew this from growing up Protestant and realizing that in my own town, pardon me, there were dozens of churches. But you really don't get a sense until you really start looking of how many different denominations there really are. I mean, and people throw out the 30,000 number, which has been kind of debunked and sort of repurposed. I mean, not every individual church is its own denomination. But I'm just looking through the conversion stories on our site, and we have dozens of them, just people from different backgrounds. We have dozens of different denominations represented. So, I mean, even if you're going to talk about a Pentecostal, are you talking to somebody who's with the Assemblies of God, somebody who's charismatic as a denomination, an independent charismatic, a oneness Pentecostal from the Word of Faith communities? I mean, within the Reformed, you got dozens of different branches. Within the Church of Christ, you got the Church of Christ, the Church of Christ United, the United Church of Christ, the Disciples of Christ. You got to know who you're talking to because you can't just throw them this ready-made thing and say, ha, if you reject this, you reject Christ. Because
right.
Chances are they may not even have a clue what you're talking about. You got to know what they're talking about in order to be able to share with them a particular approach that makes sense to them.
Yeah, I mean, even with Pentecostals, I mean, a oneness Pentecostal is radically different from a United Pentecostal. like night and day.
Oh, yeah, the United Pentecostals don't even believe in the Trinity.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's wild. So, I mean, you kind of got to know who you're talking to. I mean, Baptists, right. I mean, just think about how many different Baptist churches are in your own town. Yeah. And none of them are under the same structure of leadership. They're all under, I mean, it's crazy. So, yeah, you can't just walk into a room and say, hey, guys, I'm Catholic and you all have to listen to what I say. And those of you who reject it, that's on your soul. Right? Because chances are, I mean, unless you're going to be speaking a language they can understand, you might as well go into, you know, a foreign country and say the same thing in English and be like, well, they didn't understand me. I guess they're not open to the gospel.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a good analogy, too. So should we, like, is it good to learn about, you know, study that particular denomination? Let's say you're talking to Free Will Baptist, let's say. And so is it good to do your homework, learn everything you can about Free Will Baptist, and then engage?
I mean, I guess you could if you know who you're talking to beforehand, right?
Yeah.
But sure. You and I have both made the mistake of being like, okay, I know who this person is. I'm going to research everything about their denomination. Then I'm going to go walk in prepared. And then, of course, you walk in and you're like, well, this is not where I thought this conversation was going.
Right.
But you bring up Free Will Baptist, and of course, they're a their own animal unto themselves, because a lot of Baptists believe in predestination. I came up with a list of like a few dozen things as I was trying to prepare for this segment about how you kind of sort of walk through and figure out who it is that you're talking to. And that's one of the things that's important to figure out from the get-go. Are you talking to someone who believes in free will, or are you talking to someone who believes in predestination? Okay. Because that can change the entire color of the conversation. I mean, if this person that you're talking to believes that they are a member of the elect, selected before God, by God before all time, to be a member of his people, why should they listen to you?
Yeah, right?
I mean, but if you've got a person who believes that at the end of the day, they're accountable for every careless word that they utter, as the scriptures say, and that everything that they do, every decision they make has to either line up with God or reject God, you're talking to two different, very different groups of people, and you need to take a very different approach. If you're talking to someone who believes in predestination only, you have to kind of figure out how to show to them, no, the scriptures obviously, you know, say things like God, those he foreknew, he predestined, and things like that. But it also says that unless you persevere to the end, you will not be saved. Which brings up another question that you kind of have to ask at the beginning, maybe explicitly or maybe implicitly, which is to figure out, do they believe in once saved, always saved? Or do they believe that it's possible to lose your salvation? Yeah. Because again, you know, even these people who are non-denominational, quote unquote, often fall into one of those kind of camps, either camps that believe in once saved, always saved. You pray the prayer, you're good to go. Or you got to stay on this. And we're going to have an altar call. And some of y'all who made the commitment last week have backslidden in the last 6 days, and you need to get down here and recommit.
Right. Yeah.
And if you don't understand who it is that you're talking to, then how are you supposed to argue the Catholic faith?
That makes such a big impact. Yeah. I mean, kind of stepping back to the predestination free will thing, I know that I've dialogued with Calvinists, the Reformed, you know, very much predestination. And they'll dialogue with you just to see whether maybe you're elect as well. And then they'll decide whether or not you're elect. And if they decide against it, then it's kind of like, it's almost like you're wasting their time. They're just not interested in talking. Because after all, you're not predestined, you know?
Yeah.
What's the point?
Think about, you know, you mentioned the Free Will Baptists, which are Baptists on every point except for the fact that they believe that you can lose your salvation. I mean, that's an oversimplification, a major oversimplification.
Yeah.
But you've also got Missionary Baptists, which I'm going to oversimplify this drastically too, but
go ahead.
Some Baptists don't even believe it's necessary to preach the gospel, because if God is going to call people to be elect, he's going to do that work. We don't need to get involved with it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And you'll actually find even with some of those radical Calvinist camps, especially some of the more neo-Calvinist guys who are, they're like rad Catholic traditionalists, like rad trads, except they're Baptists, who are like, We baptize, but not because we believe that it does anything. We do it because we were commanded to do so by the scriptures. Sure, we preach the gospel, not because we believe it matters one way or the other, because the elect are the elect. We do it because we're commanded to do so. You know?
Yeah.
So you have to kind of get a sense of like where somebody's coming from on all that, because there are pieces of the Catholic faith that will make sense to a person who believes in predestination, because they're more likely to be on board with things like infant baptism. They're more likely to be on board with understanding some of the things that we believe about, you know, you're Catholic even when you fall away, right? Yeah. You may be a bad Catholic, but you're still a Catholic. They can be on board with some of those things. Whereas, you know, someone who believes in free will, they have a better understanding of kind of what we mean by the sacrament of reconciliation, and the idea of, you know, making a daily offering. Or like a morning offering, you know, they get those kinds of things in ways that someone who believes in predestination doesn't.
Yeah.
Someone who believes in predestination doesn't think that they have to get up and do a morning offering right, to commit their day to the Lord, because they're already the Lord's.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, and yeah, and also, you know, moving on to once saved, always saved, which, like you said, they're kind of close together. You know, you have certain obstacles, like with the predestined. It's almost like they could be so hardline that they don't even want to talk to you. That's an obstacle. But, you know, I've also run into, and I'm sure you have too, when you're wanting to somebody who believes in once saved, always saved. And there's always this fear that, boy, if I even examine critically that belief, I might not be saved. You know, I could,
yeah,
you know, almost in the back of their minds, they do believe they could lose their salvation if they even doubt the fact that they're
a lot of them have saved. Really not followed the question to its logical end.
Yeah.
A lot of them. So I had a Calvinist roommate in college, and it was a more of a Wesleyan Arminian free will kind of school, but he was definitely a predestination kind of guy. And, you know, you could challenge him on these points, but at a certain point he's like, well, we don't want to question these things because we don't want to call into question the sovereignty of God. That's what really is behind all of it. Okay. Really, the whole question of predestination, of once saved, always saved, it's not because you're super special and God chose you because he thought you're an amazing, you know, unicorn and everybody gets a trophy if you're elect. No, it's because they throw all their chips into the basket that is the sovereignty of God.
Okay.
And even your free will would be a challenge to his sovereignty, right? God is so sovereign that he doesn't even let you choose. He's so sovereign that you don't even get to decide on your own what you want for breakfast. God ordained what you were going to have breakfast before all time. So in some senses, you kind of have to show that we believe in the sovereignty of God, but it doesn't mean the same thing to us as Catholics as it means to someone who believes that, you know, God chose my outfit before the dawn of creation. And that's, which anybody who looks at me knows that that can't have possibly been the case.
Yeah, I don't know. I disagree. I like your shirt. And I think, you know, that does seem to reflect the beauty and truth and goodness of God. So, yeah. You know, I wouldn't totally discount that.
Today it does. I mean, but tomorrow, the 80s, I don't know.
Yeah, good point. Boy, yeah, we're coming up on the break. On the other side of the break, you know, you mentioned how predestination and free will, how, you know, some things gravitate, you know, we have connections with, some things we don't. Why don't we talk a little bit about what we connect with people that believe once saved, always saved, and the opposite. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
Awesome. You're listening to Hands On Apologetics. We're talking with Matt Swain, folks. More to come on the other side of the break. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Barbara Nicolosi, and we're having a women's conference here at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina on September 7th, 2019. This is going to be a great, great day for you to come and meet a bunch of new friends, wonderful Catholic women who want to deepen their Catholic faith and their understanding of themselves as women. You know, this era right now that we're in, so much confusion. What is it to be a man? What is it to be a woman? You know, the Catholic Church has a lot to say about this, and we're going to hear about them. We're going to hear about John Paul II's letter on women that he wrote from Mary Danielle Barber. She's going to talk about that. She's going to talk about Mary as a model for all of us. It's a topic that we can never reflect on too much. I'm going to talk about Teresa of Avila and the interior castle and how a mystical marriage is what all of us should be called to, or are called to, as Catholics in our prayer lives, and especially as women in the church. Aileen Blakowski is going to talk about motherhood and homeschooling. And then finally, we have Father Charles Murray. He's going to be the celebrant of the Eucharist. He's going to be here hearing confessions. It's going to be an amazing day. We're going to have an hour of adoration together, time to pray, time to laugh and eat, reflect, grow in our passion for our Catholic faith and our identity as Catholic women. You don't want to miss it. You want to come. You want to bring your friends. You want to bring your daughters, your nieces. That's really an affordable day. So go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org and you can register for this conference. or call 877-526-2151. The Women's Conference is going to be a great event for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles area, Southern California Catholics. You don't want to miss it.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with Master Apologist Matt Swaim about, you know, apologetics. Is it one size fits all? What should we be looking at for areas that we can build on in conversations? And Matt, you know, during the break, I was looking at the online chat here, and Michelle said, Baptrads? Question mark? Exclamation point, I guess you could add. I think you just coined a new phrase. Matt, yeah, I can't hear.
Sorry about that. I think I had my mute button on. I was just going to say we got to coin that, because the 10 people who are going to use that in the next year are going to owe us like 17 cents.
Well, I don't know. It could go viral.
I'm telling you, the neo-Calvinists are out there. They're like young, like millennials. They have big beards. They wear lots of flannel. They love John Calvin. So they're out there.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Well, you know, we're talking about understanding who you're talking to, and maybe different ways, different inroads that people would gravitate towards. And we were just talking about once saved, always saved. The belief that once you accept Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior, you know, you are going to heaven no matter what. And then there's other groups that Protestants that believe in free will, that you could lose your salvation. Let's take the easy one. What areas would Catholics and the ones that believe they could lose their salvation have in common?
Well, I mean, you just got to lead kind of jokingly with the Catholic guilt thing, right? You should be like, "Hey, this is kind of one of those points where I think that some Protestants are a little bit jealous of us, because a lot of these denominations that feel like you can lose your salvation fall into more of the Methodist category, or Assemblies of God and Pentecostal and things like that. So anything that comes out of the holiness movement, a lot of things that come out of the Great Awakening end up Baptist, but a lot of them end up kind of in the Methodist track. And for them, I think that they understand something, you know, about the nature of sin that we would agree with, and that I grew up, the handy definition was sin is a willful transgression against God. It's something that you know is wrong, but you do it anyway. And, you know, we can explain, you know, the idea of venial and moral sin to them, and that makes sense to them. But I think also there's a sort of angst that they have, and a sort of admiration that they have about the Catholic Church, but that they can't articulate, because a lot of these groups have seen, even in their own lifetime, their own denominations take things that used to be sin and either not talk about them as sin anymore, or not teach that they're sin anymore, or teach that they're okay now. And the Catholic Church hasn't done that. I mean, we got some wacky things that have gone on. We've got some chaos. You may hear a priest say something, but he's not speaking what the church teaches. You may hear a cardinal say something that seems to be in conflict with what the church teaches, but he's not changing the church teaching on something. He's just out in his opinion. At the end of the day, the Catholic Church has a moral center when it comes to the teaching of what is sin and what's not sin. Well, it hasn't changed. I remember growing up and hearing sermons all the time about the evils of divorce, you know, when I was growing up as a youth group kid in the 80s in the Church of the Nazarene. And now it's at some point divorce became okay, not because they had some vote on it and were like, okay, we've decided that we're not going to condemn divorce from the pulpit. They just kind of slid, you know, in that direction. Right. You know, and in the Catholic Church, we may have this great debate over Amoris Laetitia, but at the end of the day, the teaching is the teaching, right? The teaching is that divorce is a problem, guys. So yeah, I mean, I think for the once saved, always saved people, communicating that there is some moral center that is unchanging, because they've seen the sands shift. They've seen, you know, even on things like cuss words. Like, it used to be like one of the worst things you could do would be to say a cuss word, right? And now, I mean, you might hear some of the softer swear words from a pulpit at some of these non-denominational churches, you know. So
sure. Yeah, no, that's a really good insight. Yeah, I would never have thought that. But you're right, though. That would certainly be attractive and something to kind of explore. What about those who believe in once saved, always saved? Do we have anything that we could share or explain that would be particularly open? They would be open to hearing?
Well, see, the once saved, always saved people are such a tough nut to crack.
Yeah.
Because in some sense, they've kind of made themselves invincible, you know, to arguments against once saved, always saved, even though the scriptures are full of them. You know, he who perseveres to the end will be saved. You know, Paul talks about how I want to make sure that, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not myself disqualified after I preach to all you people. You know, Paul believes he can lose his salvation. And, you know, they'll come up with all these gymnastics to say, well, you were never saved in the first place.
Right.
Although Paul, I'm pretty sure, was saved, you know, so,
yeah,
I think you have to kind of break them out of something that's really hard to do. And that is to see scripture as a whole, instead of lifting the verses that prove their argument. Because I mean, Marcus will tell you this in his verses that he never saw. There was all these verses about losing your salvation that he either didn't see before, or that he saw, but he had a handy and clever way to explain why that's not what it actually teaches.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's a tougher nut to crack.
Let me throw out something at you, and you let me know whether you think it's a decent idea or not.
Bear in mind, I never bought into the once saved, always saved thing. I was always certain that, you know, I was going to see one dirty billboard and go to hell. So, I mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, but you've talked a lot, you know, being at the Coming Home Network and just in your conversion, all your friends and stuff. What about, you know, we Catholics do have an assurance in a sense that we know that we have grace in baptism, if it's proper form, matter, and intent, you know. So we can't doubt whether or not, you know, we are initiated into Christ. You know, there is a kind of certainty that Catholics have through the sacraments that isn't shared with the once saved, always saved, if they're non-sacramental.
Well, and the other thing, and I mentioned this sort of at the beginning, and I think it's a great point. We have a sense that we can kind of make decisions. We can make spiritual decisions for our children. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, a two-week-old can't decide what he's going to wear that day. A two-week-old can't really decide for their salvation, but their parents are charged with protecting and providing, not just in the material realm, but in the spiritual realm. And that is a form of election, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a form of destining somebody for a certain path. And on top of that, within the question of the assurance of salvation, Catholics have an assurance of salvation. You bet we do. Whether we follow the path that leads to that assurance is a different question, right?
Yeah, right.
It's not. I mean, when someone asks us the question, "Are you saved?" we say, "Well, I am confident that I will be if I stay on this. Except if I do what the church tells me to do, I'm confident that I will be saved."
Yeah, it's called the state of grace. Yeah,
right. The question is not with the path. The question is with my own frailty and woundedness and sinfulness, whether I'm going to pull it off, or with the help of God's grace, right? So, and even with that. A lot of them are under the impression that we do all this under our own power. We're a damning system of works-based righteousness, right? Mm-hmm. When in fact, it's all grace. I mean, I think that Baptists can connect with that. I mean, I'm using Baptists as the catch-all term. People who believe in once saved, always saved can connect with that if we say that none of this stuff that we can do without the aid of grace.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. So, okay. So we have, you know, a couple of things to keep in mind, folks. Does that person believe in free will or predestination? Do they believe they could lose their salvation or once saved, always saved? What other things should we look for?
Oh, man, there's no way we're going to have time for
this.
Yeah,
I know. Well, we'll do a multi-part to be continued. But
Do they come from a liturgical church or not?
Ah,
I mean, because okay. If they're Lutheran, they have a liturgy. If they're Presbyterian, they might even have a liturgy. If they're non-denominational or Assemblies of God or Pentecostal or, you know, like I was Church of the Nazarene, it's whatever the pastor decides. We're going to sing this many songs. We're going to have a talk for this long. We're going to have an altar call. That altar call may go 5 minutes, may go 10 minutes, may go an hour. We'll see. Mm-hmm. You know, do they come from do they believe that there should be a structure to worship? And if so, what does that say about the way that they believe they should approach God?
Okay.
Or do they have no liturgy at all? It's just, let's sing some songs and connect with Lord. Because, again,
what's the difference? How does the difference?
It matters greatly because those people who have that, let's just sing some songs and hear a talk and pray to God, they believe that the liturgical people, they might even believe the Presbyterians and the Lutherans are in this godless ritualistic thing. They believe that in order to connect with God, you just have to wing it and just let the Spirit move. Mm-hmm. And I think for some of them, I've made a little headway on this point by taking this approach, is saying, well, how do you rein it in if somebody starts to take over, if a personality starts to take over? Who says this has to stop?
Right.
You know, how do you keep it from being, even with that, a formula that tries to conjure God? You mess with us about our repeated prayers, right? Mm-hmm. But you're singing the same chorus in your hymn, in your little praise and worship chorus. You're singing that same chorus like 40 times until like somebody in the back passes out, right? If you go to one of those non-denominational churches where they have like the praise and worship music, you know, one song could go on for like 7 minutes and you're just singing the same like five words over and over. To kind of tap into, I mean, not to mock them, but to call out to them, well, you understand the power of repeating prayer. You understand the power of doing things a certain way. And also tap into those people who are in the non-liturgical traditions to say, why do you worship the way that you do? Are you worshiping the way that you do because you believe this is how God wants us to approach him? Or are you worshiping the way that you do because this is your favorite song? Right?
Okay.
And kind of get with that method. If you're talking to someone who comes from a liturgical tradition, the question would be, well, why do you do it that way? Why did you pick that particular liturgy? You know what your liturgy sounds like? We have pieces of our liturgy that sound like that too. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you know this, but you're just a generation or two removed from the Mass, right?
Right.
You talk to Episcopalians who come into the church and they're like, yeah, you guys have everything that we have except your Jesus is real on the altar, right?
Yeah.
Or Presbyterians confess at the beginning of their services in the liturgy. So find those pieces that connect.
Very good. We're talking with Matt Swaim about knowing who you're.
Welcome, Daniel. You're on the line. What's on your mind, brother?
Hi, I just wanted to share a testimony about Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I had a buddy at work who, you know, he's a lukewarm Catholic guy, and I wanted him to start listening to the Terry and Jesse show, so I kept telling him to download the app, and he kept putting me off. So one day, I grabbed his phone, and I downloaded the app for him. I went on vacation, and you know, I kept telling him to listen to it. He was kind of put me off. I came back from vacation. He comes to my cubicle and he says to me, hey, man, I've been listening to Terry and Justin's show and it's great. And it's made a big impact in his life. The guy, he's going to weekly adoration a couple times a week. He goes to the Mass in the morning. Mm-hmm. He's an on fire Catholic and he promotes the Terry and Jesse show and the Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Wow. Daniel, what a testimony. And I want to encourage our listeners to get those cards by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org and do what Daniel's doing. Go out and spread the faith by inviting people to listen to Virgin Most Powerful. Daniel, thanks for your testimony, brother. God love you.
You're welcome.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity. Be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show. And they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back to Hands-On Apologetics. We're chatting with Master Apologist Matt Swaim about, I guess it would be how to look at, approach different people that you talk to. You know, it's not one size fits all. You really need to know about the person, understand them, and then, yeah, you know, adjust your approach to them. And actually, right before the break, Matt brought up a really cool distinction between liturgical and non-liturgical, non-Catholic. Tell you the truth, I didn't even think about that category.
I mean, it's cool. Huge. The more I started to think about this, the more I started to realize, man, this is a long list. I mean, you could drive yourself crazy by trying to figure out all the if-then statements that you go through. But yeah, liturgy is one of them. I mean, it's a huge thing. So I didn't grow up with it at all.
In fact, I tend to notice, and tell me if your experience squares with us, that the former Catholics, if they go to a liturgical-based Protestant church, usually have a couple of gripes against either church teaching or practice. But they want, mm-hmm, so you want to experience Catholicism, but not in the church.
Yeah.
Where non-liturgical tends to be either not tends to be Catholics who, you know, they want to follow the Bible alone.
Sure.
You know, that type of thing where there's no real experience of Catholicism. That's not important.
Well, yeah. Also, have to. I mean, you've scratched on another topic it would be like a 5-hour topic, which is how to bring Catholics back to the church. First of all, you got to figure out what it was they were ticked off at that made them leave. Or did they leave because they were mad, or did they leave because they genuinely found something that they just liked better? That's a whole other question into itself. But I mean, some of these other questions, Gary, to figure out where people are on which kind of camp they're in, and I'm throwing out a lot of false dichotomies here, but
but
do they believe in a visible church or an invisible church?
Very good.
What version of the Bible do they use? Because sometimes just by figuring out what kind of version of the Bible they use, you can figure out a lot about them, right? Yeah, if they're KJV only people, they don't care what it says in the Greek. Sometimes they care how it was translated in 1611.
That's true.
Are they people who are, you know, into more of the message of the Bible, or are they into the scriptures themselves, the specific words of the Bible? Okay. I mean, that can be a whole conversation as well. What do they believe the baptism does? Do they believe baptism does anything? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do they baptize babies? Do they only baptize grown people? Is everybody in their church baptized, or is it just some people who did so as an outward expression? So you got those, but I think one of the ones that is so important to ask, because it's one that a lot of people don't really think about, is what do they believe about communion?
Yeah.
Because you can go to 15 Baptist churches that are all part of the same structure and authority and hear a ton of different answers. Like, what is communion? This is a question that a lot of Christians don't think about at all. They know that Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me, so they do it, but they don't, you know, a lot of people don't know why we do it once a year at Passover. I mean, should we do it quarterly, once a month, bi-weekly? You know, I mean, a lot of people don't know why we do it at a certain time in our little country church. A lot of people don't know what elements should be used. So it's a lot of the, you know, we always do the crackers and grape juice, you know, kind of joke when we talk about the Protestants over there. But I've had communion in I don't know how many ways, even just as a Free Methodist, going to youth group camps. And, you know, at one point I remember being in, and they pass around a loaf, a baguette, and then a, you know, just kind of a bigger cup of grape juice. And we dipped it as it went around. I went to a music festival where they had the little plastic cup that had like the double seal on top. So you had the saran wrap you peeled off to get to the cracker. Then you peeled off the aluminum foil that to get to the juice. Meanwhile, at the end of the day in the music festival, there's these gigantic industrial sized trash bags full of these communion cups with like grape juice residue in the bottom of them. And if this was supposed to be a sacred meal, why is this going out with all the uneaten Chick-fil-A? You know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's an important one to drill down into, isn't it? Because every Protestant that I've ever talked to, regardless of where they came from, I mean, they hold communion to be a very holy thing, you know, very serious thing. And some will be able to give scripture and some theological explanation for that belief. A lot don't. It's almost instinctive, like, yeah, there is something important that needs to go on here.
And that's where it stops.
Yeah.
This is important and we should do it. And that's usually where it stops. Because even as I'm looking back, I can remember times receiving communion specifically as a Nazarene and as a Free Methodist when whoever is passing the plate, sometimes the plate went down the aisle, right? Or whatever. Some people would, as they pass the plate to the next people, say, the body of Christ. They would use those words.
Yeah.
Right? Even though they didn't believe that that's what it was. There's a lot of kind of unreflective stuff that goes on around communion. I was talking with some Jehovah's Witnesses, and because they do their big campaign before Easter for us. They don't do Easter, but they do the one celebration each year, and it is the remembrance of the Lord's Supper, because that's the one holiday Jesus commanded. He didn't tell you to celebrate your birthday, dadgummit. So that's their one thing that they do. And the only people who can receive communion are those who are the members of the elect, the 144,000. And so I asked these guys, I was like, have you ever seen anybody take communion? And they're like, yeah, there's this one little old lady who's kind of independently wealthy. She lives in Germantown. She's the only person who, you know. I was like, okay, so what do you guys do with the leftovers? If it's this sacred meal that you can't partake of unless you're one of the 144,000, at the end of the meal, does she just eat it all?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. What did they answer?
He's like, "Well, it's taken care of." I'm like, "Well, yeah, okay, but how?"
Yeah,
and it was clear that he didn't even know the answer to that.
Interesting. Go ahead.
But I say all that to say that a lot of Christians participate in this memorial meal, but don't really give a whole lot of thought to it. So, I mean, you don't have to beat them over the head with transubstantiation, and you don't have to like go through this major exercise where you just like throw John 6 in their face over and over again. But sometimes just getting them to ask a question that they maybe have never asked before about communion. And again, even within one denomination, you can find a bunch of different people who have a bunch of different kind of understandings of what's actually happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a friend who is Lutheran, Missouri Synod. And, you know, and he was kind of, you know, reading Catholic material, but he wasn't at all inclined to Catholicism at this point. And he asked his pastor what he'd do with communion, you know, after the service is done. And, you know, and Lutherans believe in the real presence, substantial presence, in fact.
Yeah, they have consubstantiation is mostly what you get with them.
Yeah. It's in with and under the bread.
Right.
And the pastor said,
Jesus. Yeah.
And he asked the same question you did is, well, you know, what do you do with what's left over? And the pastor said, well, we throw it to the birds. And, you know, that was a key that he's like, something's not quite right here. How could you do that to, you know, to the Eucharist?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, this is a question that that is really, really rough for a lot of Christians because it's not something that they hear preached about. Because it's not one of the practical moral teachings of the faith. I mean, a lot of Christians get a lot of practical moral, like teachings like object lessons based on the scriptures. Like, here's how you should live your life based on what the Bible says. They don't get a lot of the, I mean, the teaching on the Eucharist is one of those, if you don't believe in the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, it's a very impractical teaching, right? Yeah. Like, Jesus told us that we should love our neighbor and feed the hungry and welcome the stranger and also eat grape juice and crackers.
You know? Yeah, like, it doesn't fit.
It's a really impractical thing that Jesus is asking us to do if it's not really him. So, yeah, and it's something that, again, and Catholics who leave the faith are still hungry for that expression, even if they can't articulate it. There's in Cincinnati, Crossroads Christian Church is this like mega church. They bought out like a warehouse and turned the whole thing into a church with like three balconies. And they have these like 57-minute services, and they have a timer counting it down in the front. And it's like smells and bells and like filtered lighting and everything. But on the back, just outside of the main entrance, there's like a little chapel. And people during the service who want to can go back there and receive, you know, bread and juice.
Huh.
As part of the service, if they want to. They figured that it was a way. I asked them about it, and they were like, yeah, we have a lot of ex-Catholics who, like to have this as part of their expression of love for Christ, to eat something while they're here, But they, of course, that's not transubstantiation, and the Catholics there don't believe it's transubstantiation.
Yeah.
But it just shows you that they just kind of don't know what to do with it, right? It's a teaching that's weird if you don't believe in the sacraments.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting how, there is that kind of interior – expectation, that there's something there that that is special and sacred and different than like even an altar call.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally the altar call that we have at every single mass, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's an opportunity for apologists to kind of step in and say, well, let me explain what, you interiorly kind of feel about this.
Well, but what I found too is if you just ask them the questions that they've never asked before, they start asking you questions sometimes. And that's the position that you really want to be in as an apologist, is get the other person to ask you questions instead of you just throwing stuff. If you can get somebody to ask questions, then you're like, okay, this is an actual conversation now.
Right. Yeah.
That's when you know you're on a decent track. Cause if they're not asking questions, it's cause they don't want to know anything.
Right. Yeah, that's gold. I mean, if you can get the point where, they're interested, they want to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. You know, Matt, as always, this has got to be the fastest hour in Catholic Talk Radio. I swear the hour just flies.
Ken Hensley was on with you the other day. He's like, I was on with Gary for 15 minutes and it took an hour.
Yeah, I know. Well, time flies when you're having fun. That's all there is to it. And apologetics is fun. So, Matt, where can people go to get, all the great stuff you do at Coming Home Network?
Sure. chnetwork.org. You can watch 22 years now of Journey Home episodes online for free. You can join our online community, which is a kind of social network full of converts and people on the journey where you can interact one-on-one with people who are asking questions. And, got some free stuff there, too, that you can download. So, chnetwork.org. Check us out.
Awesome. Well, hey, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for the invitation. Always a blast.
All right. That's Matt Swaim, everybody. Yeah, go to Coming Home Network. Great website. Lots of really good material. Boy, I tell you, it's strange, but yes, it's time to shut down the Midwest Command Center, turn off the dojo lights, and put this one in the bag. Coming up next, High Impact Catholic Talk coming at you with Terry and Jesse Show. And by the way, coming up tomorrow, I'm going to introduce you to a newcomer, Jeff Desop. We're going to talk about his journey of faith. So thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all have a great day.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church.
So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.